And we've now entered into the new phase of weather. It's now warm. How frightening is that?
Yeah, I know. It's feel alien without walking outside without a jumper now.
Yeah, exactly. We've got lots of news, of course. Do we want to start off with this week, the Israeli government approved the first phase of the Gaza ceasefire deal, commencing ceasefire as of 9 a.m. GMT on Friday, hours before the ceasefire came into effect. Israeli airstrike and shelling in Khan Yunis, southern Gaza, and attacks east of Gaza City were reported, raising concerns about Israel's commitment to the terms of ceasefire. Israel has begun to withdraw IDF, or like I like to call them, the IOF troops, but will retain control of 58% of the Palestinian territory, according to the terms of the ceasefire deal. This includes all crossings in and out of Gaza. Following...
Yeah, and in the rogue state of the United States... Following a US strike on alleged drug smuggling vessels in the Caribbean in September, statements from US military officials have increasingly suggested that strikes within Venezuela's territorial waters and land borders are being considered. Given President Donald Trump and Secretary of State Marco Rubio's claim that Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro is the leader of a designated narco-terrorist cartel, these statements raise concern that the U.S. military strikes may expand their focus far beyond cartels to the Venezuelan government.
Now, remembering, of course, that Venezuela is the biggest repository of oil in the entire world, interestingly enough.
And if you go on the Tricontinental Institute of Social Research, Vijay Prashad's think tank, you'll find so many... resources on why Venezuela, the social situation in Venezuela is what it is. It is one of the most embargoed countries with outside of Cuba. This is the U.S. Still tightening its hands around Latin America.
And if we look at the U.S. again and see it in the context of its ties to Australia, you will find that, that there was a very interesting report coming out of a Declassified Australia Special Investigation. That's an online newsletter, Declassification. Its barrels of nuclear waste material will be stored in an underground nuclear waste repository if a proposed salt mine south of Alice Springs in Central Australia proceeds. The proposal for the low-level nuclear waste dump comes as the federal government is seeking ways to manage and ultimately dispose of high-level nuclear waste from the nuclear reactors in the proposed AUKUS submarines, as well as from other defence-related nuclear and hazardous waste, including visiting US and UK nuclear-powered submarines and warships. The Chandler nuclear waste dump is proposed to be constructed within a salt formation on southern Arrernte country, 15 kilometres from Aboriginal community Tikjakala and 120 kilometres south of Alice Springs. The Northern Territory Environmental Protection Authority assessment report for the Chandler dump describes the project components as including construction of an underground salt mine at a depth of up to 860 metres, permanent hazardous waste disposal vaults within mined-out salt caverns, temporary above-ground storage facilities for hazardous waste and associated infrastructure like haul roads, access roads and salt stockpiles, and the planned international nuclear waste dump, along with a separate 200-bed accommodation precinct and airport and upgraded roads, is to be located near the Aboriginal community. the company that's supposedly being put forward to do this is Armentum Holdings, which is based in Virginia, USA, and is one of the US's largest military contractors. The company employs 53,000 people across 80 countries and provides services as diverse as chemical and biological weapons decommissioning, US Army helicopter training, to running the Nevada bombing range and the Kennedy Space Center. You should go online and have a look at Declassified's report, because it goes into a rather disturbing case study of this company's role in running a nuclear dump in Mexico, which has had a variety of spillages and other safety problems, and also talks about things like declassifying high-level nuclear waste so that it's bureaucratically changes its nature, but of course in real life doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, it's eerily reminiscent of the town in Western Australia called Wittenoom that was erased from the map. That's the town that used to manufacture blue asbestos and is now an absolute death zone with asbestos still poisoning the air.
And in fact, it's funny you should be talking about this, because there's actually a film that's going to be screened very shortly called Yugun, which is a country, and it's a statement from the people from there who are the person, the local custodian who's been leading the fight for the Western Australian government to actually clean up that site. He's recently died of mesothelioma. He wasn't working at that site. He was a ranger. And but the fight continues, because apparently, I mean, if you look at the footage on this film, the site is just devastation. And all around it is this beautiful country. And to think that the government and the company, which was originally a Lang Hancock device, which he then sold on to a corporation that then took out millions and billions of dollars of worth out of it and then just left it there. And it's not just poisoned in a location, but of course the wind takes the poison all around the country and the world. It's just staggering that we allow this sort of thing to happen.
Well, and they want to keep doing it because, like you were saying, Annie, well, actually on the Australian maps, the Australian government maps, Wittenoom's erased. It doesn't exist for
them. No, that's right.
But like you were saying before, the reality actually still exists. There are asbestos fibres blowing in the wind through that entire region and poisoning communities thousands of kilometres away.
And they don't care.
Not interested.
Not interested. Oh, there's a few jobs here. There's a few jobs here. There's a lot of death. There's lots of death. If you want to go a bit closer, what about the data centres? Our Melbourne, for example, is becoming surrounded by a variety of data centres that are supposedly going to be leading the AI revolution. And
not the revolution that we need.
Not the revolution we need, yeah. So, for example, I was reading this really interesting thing. It was just an Instagram, but it says just a little of what is happening in the America and is coming our way with data centres already beginning to ring our suburbs. It starts off with Larry Page, $204.2 billion, Google, $2.84 trillion. That's where he gets his wealth from. Jeff Bezos is worth $232.5 billion. Amazon, $2.3 trillion. Sam Altman, $2.8 billion. OpenAI, $500 billion. Bill Gates, $105 billion personal wealth. Microsoft, where it comes from, $3.9 trillion. And the person who put this up says, can someone please explain why on earth we're paying the power and water bills of their data centres? Electricity costs are up 267% 5% in areas where AI data centres are located. Sam Altman's AI empire is projected to use as much power as New York City and San Diego combined. Meanwhile, 37 states passed legislation granting sales tax exemption for data centres. Big tech gets tax breaks, you get the bill.
And when we're just coming up to the end of the roundup for the news, I mean, we got there's so much to report on. It never seems like we have quite enough time. I'll just read you a couple of excerpts from Nora Barrows-Friedman from the Electronic Intifada's report on the ceasefire. And then I have a couple of other little bits to paint a picture of what Gaza and what Palestine was like before October 7th. But I'll start quoting Nora Barrows-Friedman. Palestinians on the ground in Gaza City say that since the ceasefire talks in Egypt began earlier this week, Israel only continued to escalate its attacks. The Gaza government media office stated on Wednesday that in the 4 days since the announcement of a potential truce, Israel carried out 271 separate attacks, killing approximately 126 people, 80 of whom were killed in Gaza City. Our longtime contributor Mohammed Assad uploaded images and videos after the Israeli army destroyed his home earlier this week on October 7th in Gaza City, forcing his family to seek shelter once again. His home was damaged in previous attacks, and his family worked to clean it up and repair it, but this week it was completely razed to the ground. He's quoted saying, "Our dreams turned into a mirage," he said. The Gaza government media office released updated statistics on the 2 years of genocide, including figures on the destruction of homes, livelihood, health, and infrastructure across Gaza. Among the data set was an estimate that Israel had dropped more than 200,000 tons of explosive on Gaza since October 2023. More than 835 mosques were completely destroyed, the media office added, and at least 180 others were damaged. While 3 churches were damaged in bombings, more than half of all Gaza's 60 cemeteries have been targeted as well, 14 of which have been completely destroyed and 18 which have been partially destroyed.
Not dead enough.
No, not quite. The media office estimates that nearly 80,000 Palestinians have been killed or are still missing since the beginning of the genocide, 67,000 of whom were brought to hospitals and recorded as killed by the health ministry. Obviously, that tells you what the recording practices are like that are happening under these conditions and how low these estimates actually are. Nearly 10,000 people are still missing and still buried under the rubble, and approximately 20,000 children have been killed. Among the dead are 1,015 infants under a year old. Approximately 460 Palestinians have died from starvation, and nearly 170,000 have been injured, including 19,000 who will need long-term rehabilitation. Around 4,800 people have had their limbs amputated, nearly a fifth of them children. Israeli armored vehicles packed with explosive have continued to destroy buildings and entire city blocks around Gaza City, particularly in the Sabra neighborhood, where the video from journalist Ahmed Al-Saifi was filmed on Wednesday. That video you can go see on the Electronic Intifada website. It's really important that you go watch that. Al Jazeera's Hani Mahmoud reported on the 8th of October that Israeli forces were scaling up attacks aimed at the systemic destruction of the city's remaining infrastructure, flattening what is left of residential buildings, public facilities, and entire neighborhoods. He's quoted saying the army is reportedly using remote-controlled explosive robots alongside air attacks and heavy artillery to demolish densely built areas. Fighter jets have targeted wide boulevards and high-rise city blocks in the city center, leaving large sections of Gaza City reduced to rubble. Despite talk of a potential agreement, many in Gaza believe the Israeli military is rushing to complete the destruction before any truce takes effect. On the ground, people describe what feels like the final stages of destruction, an effort to render Gaza uninhabitable by erasing all means of life. On the 3rd of October, reporter Hamza Kurek spoke to a grandmother who survived an Israeli attack on tent shelters at the Gaza port. sitting on the floor next to a metal bed with no mattress, where two small children lay unconscious, she asks, what did children do to deserve this? Three children and their mother, who was my daughter, and my sister, over 15 people were killed in the strike. What did they do? She says that they were displaced from Jabalia in northern Gaza, and the Israeli army targeted their tent. Now, I'll just quickly pass to this. There's more of that report that you can find on the Electronic Intifada website, and I'd encourage you to go. But I'll just read you. This is a report from the 19th of September, 2023, from Save the Children Australia. 2023 marks deadliest year on record for children in the occupied West Bank.
Just remembering, this is 2023. This is
a while ago. At least 38 Palestinian children have been killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank so far in 2023, making it the deadliest year since records began, said Save the Children. This horrific record was reached this month after the death of two 16-year-old boys on two separate occasions. On average, it equates to more than one Palestinian child per week. At least six Israeli children have also been killed this year. As the second consecutive year for records of number of child fatalities in the West Bank, this highlights the worsening situation for children's safety across the occupied Palestinian territory. A Palestinian child interviewed by Save the Children last year was one of the children killed this month. His words are a haunting reminder of the fears Palestinian children face on a regular basis, and his death drives home the reality of those at risk. Yusuf said, "My dream is to be able to look up at anything on my way to school, like birds and greenery. I want to see the things I always imagine. I don't want to smell gas or see soldiers everywhere. I don't want to be scared to go outside. I don't want my mother to be scared that I might get hurt or roam the streets looking for me, fearing I was hurt by Israeli soldiers." And then I'll just skim through a couple of the quotes. Amina, a 15-year-old girl who experienced the Jenin military operation, said, "Every once in a while I sit alone in the room and start crying. I cry about everything that happened to us. I dream every day of what happened. I don't sleep until dawn and until I make sure they're not coming back for us. My daughters are not the same. My 7-year-old refuses to leave the house alone now, and once the girl hears that the soldiers are coming into the camp, they start crying and leave." And I'll take you back even further in this terrible book that I'm reading that has actually some good quotes in it. But this is a PLO soldier in the early 2000s talking about the situation. He says, "The difficulty is that they are right outside and they have guns. We live under occupation and have only our stones. We know that the stone doesn't do anything, but we're looking beyond the stone to be able to say to the outside world what we want. For now, the stone speaks for us. When the Zionists wrong us, such as the time I saw them poking an old man with sticks to make him sing, They give us the courage to do more back at them. What should I do? I have only stones. When I hear their politicians speak up about us, about getting rid of the Arabs and so on, what should I do? Should I wait 100 years for my rights? What would you do if you had lived under occupation for 40 years?